So again, good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. I want to leave time at the end for questions and answers. This morning, I thought I'd share, since you know, recent retreat and upcoming intensive on our Chan Zen tradition and the masters, of which you know, Thich Nhat Hanh is a master within that lineage that comes through China, the Chan lineage that came into Vietnam. It's important that we know our heritage and to access the wisdom of all those human beings who have come before us, just like us. Two eyes, an ear, a nose, a mouth, a body, a mind, just like us. And yet have found through the practices and teachings of the Buddhist path a means of not only freeing themselves from all their boundaries and constrictions, sufferings, but also able to realize the inherent gift that our minds, our true minds, are always affording us. So I'm reading from a book called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones by Paul Reps and Yugen Senzaki. It was in 1957, so in the ancient days when I began my Zen training, there were very few books around on Zen, and so we all had Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And again, I'm just going to read some anecdotes, but some people might say, gee, didn't Fred share this one just not too long ago? And he might have. You know, but it's really a matter of transformation. So we need to hear the teachings over and over and over again until they finally sink in and we really understand and live them. So until then, it is important that we're always willing to revisit and relook and always learn freshly. Let me come back to that one. So here's one. There was an old woman in China who had supported a monk for over 20 years. She had built a little hut for him and fed him while he was meditating. Finally, she wondered just what kind of progress he had made in all this time. So again, since we are of a different age, as you will see, we can imagine that she has been supporting a monk or a nun. But anyhow, this monk or nun had been living on her property in a little hut for 20 years, and she had been supporting him or her. And she just wondered, you know, even though she probably considered very meritorious what she was doing, she wanted to find out, is he really developing, or is she developing? So she obtained the help of a girl or boy, rich in desire, she said. Go and embrace him. And then ask him suddenly, what now? Interesting woman, eh? So the girl, or whatever, called upon the monk or nun, and without much ado, caressed and asked them, what are you going to do about it? Now, please remember, a ordained monk and nun in the Buddhist tradition has one of their prime vows is a vow of celibacy. And one of the things they have renounced that separates them from lay people is they've renounced relationship, they've renounced desire, they've renounced, right? So she asked the monk or nun what they were going to do about it. This is after she embraced them. And the monk or nun replied, an old tree grows on a cold rock in winter. Whew. Right, so basically saying what? Passionless, desireless, cold, distant, disentangled. Replied the monk, so he replied, or she replied, somewhat poetically, nowhere is there any warmth, right? So he's basically saying, I am desireless, I'm like a stone, right? So the girl returned to the old lady and related what he had said. All of a sudden, the old lady got incredibly angry. To think I fed that fellow for 20 years. He showed absolutely no consideration for your need, no disposition to explain your condition. He need not have responded to your passion, but at least he could have evidenced some compassion. So she went at once to the hut of the monk or nun and burned it down. So she was she had had it, you see. So it's very interesting, you know. It really raises the question, and that I hear that all the time. Here's another one. You've heard me read this one before. These were two monks, and again, you know, they tended to be, most of the stories tend to be monks because they were the ones who wrote these things down. Once traveling on a muddy road, a heavy rain was falling. Coming around a bend, they met a lovely girl in a silk kimono and sash, unable to cross the stream. All of a sudden, Tanzan said, come on, I'll help you. And he lifted her up in his arms and carried her over the stream. His fellow monk did not speak to him for the rest of the day until they finally reached where they were going to be lodged for the night. And then he could no longer restrain himself. Sort of like he's been seething all day. We monks have taken a vow not to go near women, especially not young ones or lovely ones, very dangerous. How could you have done that? Huh? And his fellow monk replied to him, that's interesting. I put the girl down earlier this morning, and you're still carrying her around with you. So again, you know, there's enough here to probably last the rest of the morning. So, you know, it's really that issue in the first one, right, where she burned down the, and it really comes up a lot when people often, often interviews or other times express they're frustrated with their practice. They're disappointed with themselves in their practice, right? And when I ask them, well, what are you talking about? You know, what is your practice that you're so frustrated with or disgusted, or you're disgusted by the way you're practicing, or you're so disappointed because you were doing so well and now you're not, you know. And they always would talk about their meditative practice. Right? You know, the time they're giving to it, or their ability to concentrate or not get lost in thought, or, you know, I mean, most of the time, this is when they talk about their practice, this is what they're referring to. And my usual reply is, that's not your practice. You know, our practice is to become a certain kind of human being. That's our practice. To be an awakened human being. To be a compassionate human being. To be an understanding and loving human being, to be a patient human being, right? That's our practice. And so, now again, we spend a lot of time in our tradition meditating, but meditation is not our prime practice. It is a means to help us become a certain kind of person. Is that clear? And so I think you've heard me say, I mean, it's always was, I don't know if it's still the case, but when I was more on the road in my earlier days, and you run into lots of other Dharma practitioners, or you're in Dharma communities, you know, people are often talking about how their practice is going. You know, like that's their major consider. How's your practice going? And usually they're talking about what? How their meditative practice is going. Not how their life is going. You know, and again, I think this is very misplaced. And I caution all of us to keep things in perspective. We have entered this path to heal and transform and awaken. Right. And meditation, concentration, mindfulness, insight are means to help us do that. But if our concentration, mindfulness, and insight is quite profound, but still, the way we relate to our fellow human beings and the kind of mind states that we cultivate, so what? I mean, that's a little extreme, but so what? Our mindfulness, our concentration, and insight should help us, should make it easier to heal and transform. And this is very important for us to remember. And again, I'm saying that because, like in the first one, why was she so disappointed in him? You know, if she thought, right, after 20 years of practice, he should be, right, if he's a monk, after 20 years of practice and renunciation, he should be able to be seduced by the most attractive being that he could possibly be seduced to, and he would what? It'd be like a stone, cold, indifferent. In traditional Buddhism, that's called sort of like an arhat, someone who's cut off all the passions, all the desires. They are. And traditionally, this was the ideal of traditional monastics, right? To become an arhat. But in the Mahayana, our ideal is to become a bodhisattva, and a bodhisattva, I think this is why she burned down the hut, is somebody who is, you know, let's say if you're a monastic, is able to renounce, right, unskillful activities and to fulfill their commitment. So if you've made a commitment to be a celibate and this is your commitment that you've made for your life, that's fine, okay? But I think what the old lady is saying, but that woman who was trying to seduce you was a human being, right? And it's your duty, your higher duty is to help her. You see, to help her, right? To maybe try to understand why she's doing what she's doing, right? To perhaps explain to her, to get lost in desire, to only seek the fulfillment of your own desire without considering the other person only leads to suffering. Only leads, you see? So there are many things he could have said to her and turned that situation into an experience where he could have helped her, you see? But he didn't do that, did he? Because he was just totally in himself. Right? And our practice is to get out of ourself. I mean, it's to honor the precepts, honor our values, honor our ethics. But there's a higher ethical moral consideration in the Bodhisattva way, which is to bring benefit to others. To help others, you know. And sometimes you may even, again, if your mind is very clear and your mind is really free of self-interest, to engage in something which may be a bit of an ethical challenge, because you are really doing what you can to benefit another human being. Is that clear? Or benefit the situation as a whole. I mean, it's very clear in the Bodhisattva precepts that those are the instructions, right? You know, that the higher precept is the precept of serving others, right? And so Obviously, this monk, even though he had properly practiced meditation diligently for 20 years and was maybe a great meditator, and he could go into all kinds of samadhis and trances, et cetera, but he couldn't deal, you know, with the reality of this human being. And his only way of dealing with her was to cut himself off. See, again, and in the Mahayana, it's not a path, we don't follow a path of renunciation, we follow a path of understanding and compassion. That is our liberation, right? So he could, again, he could have explained to her, great teaching opportunity, explain to her how desire leads to suffering, how the pursuit of temporary pleasure, such as a sexual encounter, is just transient and doesn't last. And whatever was feeding that will just simply arise again once that desire for pleasure is fulfilled. You see, I mean, it was a great opportunity he missed to really be of benefit to her. So what do you think? He deserved to have his hut burnt down and driven away? See, they were tough ladies in those days. They didn't mess around. In the other one, again, which again, you see the, I mean, it, at a certain level, it is that dilemma, right? The one monk who was so upset that his brother monk helped this young woman carry her across the stream, even though as a monk, he really was not supposed to be touching, you know, someone of the opposite sex or somebody like that. So even though he was breaking his vow, so to speak, he was doing it to be of help, you know. And you can so, but his fellow monk, you know, I think the story, you can do it on two levels. So he was, you know, rigid, right? You know, he couldn't get over, and he was angry that his fellow monk would even think of, you know, in not only encountering her, but just picking her up and carrying her across and setting her down. So again, that's I think showing this dichotomy between these two paths and just the way they deal with the situation. So we'd say the first monk dealt with it in a good way. He was helpful, and then he just moved on. You know, he didn't ask for her phone number or anything. So that was a good something good. But I think the deeper thing for us is when 8 hours later, the second monk, brought up how he was seething about what had happened. And the first monk, basically said, you're the one who's still holding on to this experience. I put her down 8 hours ago, and it's not even in my mind. I just responded, and I did it. It happened. And so I think is something that we can all relate to. This way we hold on to things. Right? Something happens. And what do? We grab it, chew on it, we repeat it, we build up an emotional response, we build up a story, just continues to grow intense, and then, like this first monk, at some point it just, something explodes out at the other person. And that whole process is going on because why? Because something that happened an hour ago, or hours ago, or days ago, or years ago, we have continued to what? To hold on to grasp at, to chew on, to intensify, to have an emotional response. And it's all going on where? In our mind. None of it is real, right? I mean, that's what this first monk is saying. You know, the reality of the experience was, encountered a young lady, she was having trouble fording a stream, I picked her up, I set her down. You know, and then I went on with the rest of my day. Well, the other one, resentment, anger, disappointment, hurt. Right? Who knows, you know, the emotions of that first monk. So again, I would certainly encourage us with the second story to really look at, is that me? How many events of my day, after they've ended, positive and negative? I mean, the positive ones, you know, may be going on just as much, but you know, they engender positive feelings. So we don't really attend to those. But you see, the problem is, if that is the way our mind operates, we will be doing it for both. You can't just have a pass. If we are holding on to the experiences of our day positive, then we'll probably hold on to negative too, and vice versa. Or maybe we just do one or the other. But, you know, what does living in the present moment mean? Everybody knows that teaching. What does "there's no past, there's no future" mean? It means just this, that reality unfolds right now, and it's appearing and disappearing, experiences are appearing and disappearing, coming and going. That's all that's going on all day, all night. That's all that's going on, right? Once something has happened, it's over. That is the nature of all experience. But it is our minds that grab onto it, that want to hold on. And since we can't hold on to the reality, because the experience has already passed, there's no way you can hold on to reality, because reality is endlessly unfolding and changing, it's in process. Then the only way we can hold on to it is to freeze it in our minds, like freeze the photo. You know what I mean? It's like taking a picture and then just looking at it all day. But it's just a photo. Right? It's not real. I mean, everybody understands that, right? Everybody knows the difference between the real event and the photo of the real event. I mean, I'm just checking that we're all in the same reality. Very important, right? The picture of the person is a picture of the person. It's a representation of the person. It is not the person, the living, breathing person themselves. Everybody knows that, right? Yes. And yet, our thoughts and images that appear in our mind are the same. And yet we what? We attach to them as if they're real. And we stare at them as if we're staring at a real thing. Now again, it doesn't mean, you know, you know, that we don't live in the world of thoughts and images and feelings. I mean, if you see a picture of something, of someone, you know, and it invokes a feeling, if it invokes an experience, if it invokes a memory, you know, now you're touching something that's arising in the moment spontaneously in your encounter with that picture. But then we grab at it, you see. We fix it. And we want to hold on to it. And that's the slippery slope. Right? Because the nature of our own mind, the nature of the way our mind operates, and as anybody who meditates can attest to that, and we talked about that this morning, mind awareness is the host. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, images, experiences, they're endlessly coming and going. They have no substance. They have no stability. So why hold on to them? Anyhow, you can ask me questions later. Maybe there's a good reason to hold on to them. I'm willing to be convinced. So this is an interesting one. A young wife fell sick. She was about to die. "I love you very much," she told her husband. "I don't want to leave you. Do not go from me to any other woman. If you do, I will return as a ghost and cause you endless trouble." So again, please, women, forgive this. These were written by men, but it could be the other way. Anyhow, it's an interesting, right? Right. Somebody is dying. They're very close with their spouse or partner, and they're saying, "You dare to take up with anybody else, I will haunt you." I mean, we know stalkers. People do that even while they're while people are alive. It's so it's not unknown, right? I mean, a lot of the violence that's perpetuated is around this issue. Soon the wife passed away, and guess what? Even her husband probably told her, "Don't worry, I will always remain true to you." 3 months later, he met another woman, fell in love, became engaged, and married. Immediately after the engagement, a ghost appeared every night to the man, blaming him for not keeping his promise. And the ghost was very clever. She told him exactly what had transpired between himself and his new sweetheart. Whenever he gave his fiancée a present, the ghost would describe it in detail. She would even repeat conversations, and so it annoyed the man so that he couldn't even sleep. Someone advised him, "You should take this problem to a Zen master." At length, in despair, the poor man went to the local Zen master for help. So the master said to him, "Sounds like your former wife has become a ghost and knows everything you do. Whatever you say or do, she knows. She must be a very wise ghost. Really, you should admire such a ghost. The next time she appears, I suggest, but she's so smart, you bargain with her. Tell her that she knows so much, you can hide nothing from her. And that if she will answer you just one question, you promise to break your engagement and remain single for the rest of your life." Very interesting. So the man obviously said, "What question must I ask her? Ask her." So it's very interesting. Now, Zen is always known for being very down to earth, practical, not up in the air, like very real. So the master said, "Take a large handful of soybeans and ask her exactly how many beans do I hold in my hand. If she cannot tell you, you will know that she is only a figment of your imagination and you will no longer be troubled by her." The next night when the ghost appeared, the man flattered her and told her, "She's so wise, you know everything I do." "Indeed," replied the ghost, "I even know you went to see the Zen master today." "And since you know so much," the man demanded, "tell me right now, how many beans am I holding in my hand?" Immediately, there was no longer any ghost to answer the question. Now, why do I consider this a very interesting story? What if I suggested, sort of like our previous discussion, that our thoughts, our perceptions, our memories, our inner conversation, are all ghosts. Even if it's very perceptive and wise, it is just a ghost. A ghost is what? Anybody know what a ghost is? And again, you have to remember that traditionally in many cultures, I mean, being, you know, if you said you were haunted by a ghost, people took it very seriously. They believed it. So a ghost is what? Anybody ever see a ghost? Yeah, so it, but they're beings who actually look, have a form, and can speak, but they have no substance. I mean, they have no solidity. They have kind of a formless form, an illusory form, right? And yet, they do appear. This woman appeared. The ghost appeared. She looked exactly like his ex, and spoke to him very wisely. As long as he believed she was real, he suffered. Right? He couldn't sleep because she seemed to know everything he had done, right? See, and we have something within our mind, right, that has tracked us our whole life and seems to know everything we've done and has no problem always reminding us. I mean, many people, there's a part of me that's always reminding me of all the things I've done or the things I shouldn't have done, right? You know that one? So what did the Zen master do? Did he give him a lecture and a talk and ask him to read a sutra? No, he did something very wise. Right? The beans in his hands were real, weren't they? They were concrete, weren't they? Right? And so when he thrust reality right in the face of the ghost, it couldn't answer, could it? And he realized that the ghosts that he had been so afraid of, and he, you know, giving him sleep and sleepless night one after the other, was just a figment of his imagination, right? It's so simple. Let's say everybody close their eyes and just remember the last time, you were angry, you were hurt, you were afraid, you were worried, you were sad about something, you know, okay? Just kind of remember what that was like. Go into that story and go into the feeling. Right? And when you're in that world of your thoughts and your feelings and your memories, doesn't it appear very real to you? Don't you feel it? Yeah. Now, right now, immediately, open your eyes and see what's right in front of you. Just look. This is reality. And what happens as soon as you look and see what's really going on in reality right now? What happens to those, that whole drama? Where does it go? Gone. All you had to do is what? Open your eyes and connect with reality. Could it be that simple, as the Zen master, you know, was teaching, right? Right? I mean, he could have, those who are aware of traditional societies who believe in ghosts and possessions, you know, you would have called for the exorcist, right? And they were very, you know, you'd call for the shamans and the exorcists, and they'd come and they'd do a vast ritual to free you of the ghost, right? The Zen master said, no, just give the ghost a test. If she's so wise, you know, and she can see everything that you're doing, she certainly would know how many soybeans you're holding in your hand. I mean, that's a simple thing, isn't it? But the master knew that the ghost wasn't real. And its wisdom was not a wisdom based in reality. It was a wisdom just making, observation. This ghost was following him around, but the ghost had a story, right? See, the ghost had a bias, didn't it? The ghost was not just a disinterested person. The ghost had a bias. And the bias was what? I'm going to ruin your life because of what you did and what you didn't do, right? And many of us have a mind that is biased. It's biased against ourselves, it may be biased against others, it may be biased against the world. I mean, who knows what our biases are, right? Our minds at this point are not objective, disinterested players in our life. Is that clear? Even when it looks at our history, it picks and chooses. Do you understand that? It picks and chooses. It's not looking at the whole picture and all the experiences. It's picking and choosing. Even when you're into something with somebody else, you know, it's picking and choosing, right? When you're angry at somebody or hurt by somebody, are you also aware of their good qualities? Are you also thinking about all the nice things they've done? Have you noticed you're not doing any of that? Why not? Biased. Against. You're like the ghost. We have our own ghosts. There are our thoughts. They're not real. They're illusory. What's real? This is real. What's unfolding in the present moment? This is real. The more we're able to live in reality, and the less we live in the irreality, the unreality of the past and the future, the more we will, you know, feel freedom in our life, right? So when the, when all of a sudden he was free of the ghost, he could what? He could get on with his life, right? He could just get on with his life, do what needed to be done. Many of us, we were not free because we're still haunted by the ghosts. Just like, what's his name? Scrooge. Ghosts of Christmas past, Christmas futures. So let me share one more. And it reminds me actually of a very famous Chan Zen mundo between, back and forth between the first patriarch of Zen, Bodhidharma, and the second patriarch. So a Zen student came to Bankei. Bankei was a great Japanese Zen master centuries ago, and he complained, "Master, I have a terrible, ungovernable temper. Please help me. I need to cure it. It always gets me into trouble. Please help me." Bankei said, see how Zen masters work, right? They don't kind of like send him to an anger management class or give him something to read, right? Said Bankei. So he goes along with him. "Wow, that sounds like you have something very strange, something very terrible inside you, yeah, that you want to cure. Do me a favor, can you let me see, you know, what it is that you have?" And the man replied, "Actually, right now, I really can't show it to you." That means his anger. I can't show it to you right now, actually. So Bankei says, "Oh, that's interesting. When can you show it to me?" And the student says, "Well, you know, I never know, it arises unexpectedly. I can't like predict it'll be, you know, at 4 p.m. or something." "Well then," said Bankei, "then your anger must not be your own true nature. If it were, you could show it to me anytime. When you were born, you did not have it, and your parents did not give it to you. Please reflect on this." So again, this is again, you see, the kind of brilliance of Zen, you know, not long-winded answers, not long explanations, but using reality and questioning to help the student wake themselves up, you see. He could have given him the answer, couldn't he? But instead, he sort of go, "Oh, that's very interesting. You really have this terrible thing called anger. Yeah, wow, anything is, and it's really just causing you great disturbance. Anything as terrible and big as that, you know, must be something quite something. Please, please show it to me. Can't find it. Well, that's interesting. I thought it was so big and significant. Can't find it. Oh. Well, that means it's not here all the time. If it's not here all the time, means it's not permanent. Means it's impermanent. I mean, it just rises according to causes and conditions. It's not your true nature. It's not really who you are. Why are you so identified with it, you see? He's really asking. Think it over. You know, again, it's from the, it's the same kind of talk that the second, and you've heard me refer to it, the second patriarch of Zen, who was really just Bodhidharma's first student. Bodhidharma was the Indian who brought the teachings that came to be known as Chan or Zen from India to China. And, you know, I've given the stories about this in the past, but he's, you know, he's basically not teaching anybody. He doesn't think the Chinese are ready for the direct path. And so people come and they he ignores them. He doesn't teach them. And then eventually became the second patriarch, comes to him and asks, and Bodhidharma's in the cave. And Wiko comes and he requests teachings. Please teach me, Master. Bodhidharma just ignores him. Right? And so, according to the story, Wiko just sits outside the cave all night. It's the middle of winter. So it's cold, it snows all night, and he just sits out there. And then in the morning, when Bodhidharma, maybe he's going out to urinate or something, you know, comes out of his cave, Wiko's there. And again, I don't know if it really happened, but in the story, he cuts off his arm and offers it to Bodhidharma as a sign how you know, he's serious. So Bodhidharma, when he realizes he finally has a serious disciple, asks him, you know, what is it? What is it that brings you here? But you got to remember, Wiko's in a real state, right? He's suffering. He's obviously very focused and emotionally. Just he's been up all night in the cold, just offered. And he says, Master, my mind is never at ease. Please, Master, put my mind at ease. And Bodhidharma says, right now, show me this mind that has no ease. And in that moment, supposedly, Wiko came to enlightenment. Now, what do you think that was about? What was he enlightened to? It was really the same thing that we heard in the other story, right? Wiko, he's totally consumed with his thoughts and his suffering and his sense of lack and something missing, and he's got to get the answer, and only Bodhidharma can give him the answer. And you see what, you know, I mean, like that state. And Bodhidharma turns it around. Good. Show me this mind that is so disturbed. And in that moment, we can imagine Wiko just looks directly into his mind, looking for that mind of disturbance, and sees nothing. What does he see? Just vast, empty space. Spacious awareness beyond birth and death. In that moment, he sees clearly who and what he really is. His problem, he's been what? He's been identifying with his thoughts, his needs, his wants, the drama. No one told him about host and guest, right? So he's been lost in the world of his guests. And Bodhidharma just got him to turn and look directly at the host. See your see. And all of a sudden, there were no guests. There was only the host. And immediately, Wiko was awakened to that. Immediately, all the drama, all the affliction fell away. And Bodhidharma would teach him. So it's 11:30, we have time, and I know recently hasn't. So I'm up to taking questions. Ray Lynn, for people at home, most people are at home, please chat in your question. People in the meditation hall, is there a microphone? Excuse me. Is it on? So, or David? Or who, Pat is looking like, I don't know what to do with this thing, but David does. So anybody in the hall have a question? Just put your hands together. Anybody at home have any question about the anecdotes, or more importantly, about the teachings and how to apply them in your life? Please take a moment, reflect, and I'm open for any question about any of them. Do I need to go over the ones we did? Yes, here's Max.
Yeah, thank you, Fred. It's, the past couple of weeks I feel like have been, teachings on Zen and things like that. And whenever I hear these teachings, I feel a hesitancy to...
Is what?
A hesitancy.
A hesitancy within you?
Yes.
Uh-huh, because?
To, reflect on them or practice them. Mm-hmm. So I realize that, Buddhism is a developmental path, and this seems... the mindful living, Dharma, wisdom, this seems kind of up there.
Well, if that's what you want to say, you can say that. How up there is it? Like, where is it? I mean, what's so hard about any of it? I mean, it's very simple. I mean, let's say you're in the mindful living path. What are you learning? To live in the present moment. To not hold on to the past, to not live in the future. Isn't that the mindful living path? Isn't that what you're hearing today? I mean, even if it wasn't about the turning around and looking directly in your mind, if you were living the mindful living path, wouldn't you be doing most of what these anecdotes are pointing out to us? I mean, I'm not clear what's so difficult. That makes you hesitant.
Yeah, I guess it's mostly the looking.
Yeah, but even again, mindful living path is learning to understand that our thoughts are preoccupied with thoughts of the past, thoughts about the future, and not living in the present moment. Which means what's happening right in front of us, right? When you drink a cup of tea, you just drink a cup of tea. When you're looking at me, we're talking, you're just here. You understand that? So just practice that. That'll probably end much of your self-created suffering right there. What do you think? Good deal of it. And then as you develop and really look into the nature of your own mind, the nature of self, that'll only support that. But, just really getting, past, future don't really exist. There's only the present moment. Let me learn to live in the present moment. Right? Let me learn to let go of my holding on. To these things that have no substance? I mean, is it really that hard to see that your thoughts have no substance? Just look at a thought right now. Do they have any substance?
There's nothing.
What?
There's nothing.
What'd you say?
Nothing.
What?
Oh, there is nothing. They don't have
any. You know, they don't have any substance. I mean, if you said, Fred, oh, I got these, this past couple of weeks, I've really been about this and that. And you know, it's really just overwhelmed me. And if I said, can you please show me those thoughts right now? I'd like to see them. Can you show them to me?
No.
How about even that thought that you began with today? In listening to these teachings, I have all this hesitancy. Can you show me your hesitancy? Just look in your mind for your hesitancy. Is there really any hesitancy?
No.
Ghosts. You probably think you're a very modern person, don't you, Max? Don't believe in ghosts. Thank you, Max.
Thank you.
Yes, Ray Lynn.
Does the old lady simply get a moral or ethical pass for burning down a monk's house?
What?
Does the old lady simply get a moral or ethical pass for burning down the monk's hut? It seems peculiar that she would demand great compassion from the monk and respond so uncompassionately.
Really? So that's whoever is asking the question, that is their opinion. Is that true? Yeah. So you know, everything's in the eye of the beholder. You know, Buddhism... In Mahayana Buddhism, compassion is not necessarily always being nice. Many people get confused. Right, we might say, that old lady burning down that monk's house, that wasn't very nice, was it? That wouldn't make him happy, would it? Ooh, that might make him angry at her, right? That's the way many of us think. But that's wrong thinking. Compassion, real compassion, is we want to end somebody's suffering. That's true compassion. We want to help somebody wake up. Right? That's true compassion. And so this old lady, seeing, we might say up to then, she probably thought, ooh, I'm really quite a compassionate, ethical Buddhist practitioner, because look what I do. I give a home to this monk. I support his practice, right? She probably felt quite proud of herself. What a good Buddhist she was, earning lots of punya, lots of merit, supporting a monk. But when she heard the answer, she realized she was not helping him at all. We might say from a modern point of view, she was enabling the continuation of his wrong practice, his wrong thinking. And so oftentimes, some kind of very direct action like that, while it may appear, not very nice, right, could have been just what he needed. And hopefully she kind of explained to him why she was burning down his hut and telling him to move on his way, right? I mean, she's the one who's been supporting him. I mean, some people have to do that, I know, over life. Some people have to do that with their children. Right? Or some of their relatives that they've been taking care of and supporting thinking they were helping them, but then finding out it really wasn't helping them at all. It was just enabling them. I mean, we know that today. So to all of a sudden tell whoever you've been taking care of, I'm not going to take care of you anymore. You know, you have to earn your own way. I'm not going to bail you out of jail anymore. I'm not going to, always keep bailing you out of the situations you get yourself in. That's not helping you, right? I'm just facilitating, the perpetuation of this dysfunctional or suffering way you lead your life, you see? So outwardly, you might go, wow, she was very or he was, the father was very cruel to his son, right? And the son and daughter might, how might they feel about the parent or whoever else has been enabling them when they're cut off? Happy? No, not happy at all. Angry, hurt, right? So, I mean, do you get it? So, you know, we have to be careful when we judge actions, right? Because there can be actions that look very good or nice that really may not be helping. They may be perpetuating suffering. Perpetuating the continuation of dysfunction, right? I mean, is that clear? On the other hand, there can be actions that seem a little abrupt or, you know, or cruel or something, but, you know, they are really meant to be helpful. And so we have to be very careful when we judge others, because again, to help another human being takes intelligence, takes wisdom. It can't just be a kind of a knee-jerk, here, take, right? I mean, if a drug addict comes up to you and says, hey, can you give me some money? I need to go buy drugs because I'm in a bad way. I mean, is that what do you do? You can give him the money, but then you're what? Which will make him happy, make her happy, but we're just perpetuating their suffering, right? To say, look, you're in a bad way, I'm very happy to take you to detox. That might be a much better decision, right? Person may not be happy. They might get angry, but that's okay. Right? So, if you really want to help people, you have to kind of really see the situation and really be clear, what do I want to do? Am I just here to perpetuate, enable the continuation of someone's suffering, or do I really want to help them? Right? And in the Mahayana, we want to help people be free of their suffering. So to be free of their suffering means we have to help them be free of the delusions, the wrong thinking that support their suffering. That's why in Buddhism, we really look at the mind and sort of that's what's really often sustaining people's sufferings. So this is very important. Heather, so thank you for the question. Heather, any other questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Like the ruminating monk in the stream crossing, I find that some specific thought chains can be very persistent.
Yeah.
Is this fixation? What are your suggestions for recognizing these persistent thoughts as guests?
Well, so, I mean, obviously the first thing is to be really working that host and guest thing, right? And, so, I mean, again, that even getting that one is a kind of restructuring of experience, Oh, I get it. But do we really get it? I mean, are we willing throughout the day, no matter what's arising in our mind, always see that the arising of experiences are simply the guests? And it's not just only thoughts, it's all experiences. Things are just happening all day long, right? Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories. Things are just, right, all day long. That's what we're dealing with. Are we willing to get acknowledged that that's what's unfolding, and yet there's always something here, we might say, that is always aware of all that? And so am I willing to really kind of call that which is here and is aware the host and label everything that's arising as the guests? Okay, so that's kind of the general way to proceed. The problem with a lot of these so-called persistent obsessive thinking is they're not just simple thoughts. They are tinged with emotionality and self. The more the I is present, the more the I can't believe, I this, I that, how could somebody say that? How can somebody do that to me? You know what I mean? The more the I and self is contaminating that whatever happened, the more emotionality, right? Those are called, you know, those make it more difficult, right? So you have to be strong, you know. But if you don't have any strength, if you haven't built up any strength in your mind from meditation, from other activities throughout your day, where you are able to distinguish host from guest just in the normal stuff, you know, little urges, little desires, little needs, little, you know, I mean, if you're still kind of, you know, following every thought that arises, every urge, every desire, every irritation, you know what I mean? if you're still doing that all day, right, every worry, every, you know, obviously, for the bigger stuff, when the mind really gets fixated, you know, we don't have any strength. You know, Max talked about a developmental path. I mean, so we need to build up our own mental strength, the strength of our mind, right? And so, you know, often the case, you know, we're most concerned about this big stuff. But again, we can't handle the big stuff because we're still not even handling the small stuff, right? We're still just following our mind around all day and follow, you know, monkey see, monkey do, sound we're looking, sight we're looking, you know, and if something happens, we're having an opinion about everything, right? So, I mean, if that's what's going on all day, don't expect that all of a sudden when something, you know, which in our ego delusive mind always says, no, this is really important. Right, you know what I'm saying? This is really big. You know how our mind elevates anything to do with us to, you know, this is really big. Or self, you know, oh, I'm really justified on this one. Oh yeah. Right? I mean, you know, it's we're just throwing gas on the fire. And then we go, yeah, well, how come I'm having trouble putting it out? Well, you're throwing gas on the fire. That's not how you put it out. You put it out by what? I mean, even without the more profound, the simple, you know, of this just being able to identify, you know, and let go. Just guess, coming and going. But even if there's some kind of attachment or grasping at the guess, even if you forget about that, you know, just the other practices we do, you know, understanding. Am I willing to, like I said earlier, are we willing to understand that whatever the person or situation is, that I got to force myself to remember that they are more than just what happened. They are more than just what happened. You know, we reduce life and experiences like the little sound bites. You know, yeah, people are complex. People do good things and people don't do good things, right? People have been kind to us and people have been less than kind to us. People have been generous to us and you know what I mean? And oh, there's a context in which this situation's occurring. But if you don't see this, if you're unwilling to look at the context, you know, then it's very difficult. So just opening up, willing to be understanding, willing to say, oh, that other person is just, you know, they're just the unfolding of their own causes and conditions. They really can't help themselves. You know, if I had grown up in their household and if I have had every situation that in life that they'd have, I'd be doing the same thing that they are. Right? So, I mean, there's very simple ways that we can be looking at life, you know, that are not the same as, you know, this host guest, which is, as Max said, a deeper. But But if we're not even willing to reflect in a dharmic way, understanding cause and effect, understanding karma, understanding the context in which things are arising, you know, if we're unwilling to be compassionate, you know, well, maybe this person could possibly be that they're suffering. That's why they're doing what they do. You know, like, that's an interesting thought. Try that next time you're really angry at somebody, to be compassionate. To think, oh, you know, why would somebody do that? What's going on with them? What's it like to be them now? Not very pleasant. So we awaken some heart within us. Okay. Thank you, Raylin. Thank you, everybody. We should probably end now.